You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
Valkyrie, what does this word bring to mind? You may envision the European nobility riding through the countryside with a majestic hawk on their outstretched leather-enveloped hand. Using hawks and falcon for hunting dates back to ancient times. Few people still hunt with birds, but falconry enables these spectacular creatures to enjoy a symbiotic relationship with man. They also serve an important role as sentinels to the health of our planet. I had the pleasure of visiting with two licensed falconers in San Diego, California, at Sky Falconry, where I was privileged to fly a trained bird and, for a while, touch the sky through the wings of a Harris hawk.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Yuppie Puppy City Kitty provides pet lovers an opportunity to earn up to 50% commission selling our premium pet products. Advocate Gina Brick says, the opportunity to share such a quality product line with other pet lovers is amazing. The support of the Yuppie Puppy City Kitty family while working the business is a true gift. Mention special code PETLIFE when you enroll today and receive 3 additional products free. Find us at www.ypckpets.com. That's ypckpets.com.
It's hard to find time for your furry family member. That's where Camp Bow Wow comes in. All-day play and overnight camp, daycare and boarding for dogs. Everything is included. Large play areas for fun and exercise. Spacious cabins, comfy cots, even live camper cams to watch from a computer or smartphone. Camp Bow Wow offers the best care and is the place to go where a dog can be a dog. For locations and more information, visit campbowwow.com.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
I am surrounded by some bit of nature that is just unbelievable. I'm in the foothills of San Diego, just having experienced Sky Falconry and having the pleasure of speaking to the owners of Sky Falconry, Kurt Selinger and Denise Disahorn.
Disharoon.
Oh, it was so close. Thank you, Denise. Yeah, I appreciate that. Number one, give me a little bit of background, Kurt, of what is falconry, and then we'll get into your background, too.
Okay, well, what is falconry? Well, the technical definition, if you want to be very technical about it, is the taking of quarry in its natural habitat with a trained raptor. And, of course, all the training and upkeeper husbandry that goes into it. But basically, just hunting with a bird of prey or raptor is a okay definition.
With so much suburbs, urban areas, like, really, how does somebody have a chance to fly a bird in a wild enough area to do this? Is it something that's that popular in the United States, that common?
Well, it has been going on for a while, but there's probably only around 3,500 to 4,000 registered falconers in the United States. So we were probably at around 10,000 at our peak some decades ago, but that's gone down a little bit and probably maybe in part due to urbanization. But there are a lot of falconers that do live in the cities, and they just have to be willing to, get in the car and, spend some money on gas and get out there.
Denise, give me a little bit of background about falconry. This is not a new sport. Sometimes people think of it as, oh, yes, I know you look at the aristocracy in Europe and they had their falcons and they would go out, or maybe even Arabian Nights thinking of them. But this is a fairly ancient sport.
It is indeed. From our research, we can see that the Chinese date their falconry back around 5,000 years. It goes even further back, 8,000 to 10,000 years, with the Mongolian, the Persian, and Kazakh cultures. Mm-hmm. That's right. So it has been around for a very, very long time. Here in the United States, we really do not think it had a strong presence until after the Great World Wars. Our boys that were lucky enough to make it back saw the sport being practiced abroad and brought it back home with them. As far as we know with the native cultures, there's not a lot of evidence that they actually practice falconry. They revered raptors, they use their feathers in ceremony and for decoration, but there's no evidence of that symbiotic working relationship with raptors.
What I found interesting is you were talking about, you can be out there, you have the bird on your glove, and that was just amazing to feel the strength. And I want you to tell all the background and the specifics of the biology and physiology of these birds. But there was a real purpose to having these birds when you were a nomad or the ancient Chinese. What were they really used for? So was it just hunting to watch the bird hunt?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. Love doing it, especially before TV and things like that. But hunting. Definitely a lot easier for that bird to go chasing after something than you yourself. So hunting is what it's all about. And everything else that we do with raptors is based off those falconry or hunting with the raptors techniques.
So it's actually to bring food home to the family, right? So that's why that relationship is really built between the falconer and the raptor, because together they can work to take down bigger game, right? That you can't actually feed your family with, like jackrabbit and duck and pheasant and quail, as opposed to, you know, other smaller things that raptors would naturally hunt as well, like rats and mice and voles.
Especially before you had guns and
sure.
ways of doing it. You know, how did you get that bunny that was running? You could have your bow and arrow possibly, but this way you had your raptor that went out. What birds are typically flown for falconry?
Well, here in the United States, we actually will use our native species as well as exotic species from all over the world. But generally, buteos, so broadwing hawks, as well as falcons, which are considered long wings. And also, some people do hunt with owls. They are a little more difficult, for sure. We like to call them highly involved instead of intelligent, I suppose. And also eagles. Golden eagles are fantastic. They're a little too big of a bird for us to work with the public, but spectacular indeed. And you can also, you know, take down bigger game like Mongolians and other places. They will hunt wolves with these eagles. It's unbelievable. Yeah, you definitely need to, once you're done listening to this podcast, go to YouTube and check it out.
Oh my goodness. So I've never would thought of taking down a carnivore, something that large.
Absolutely. That's part of a lot of cultures, you know, and their, what should we say, kind of their history, right? So Mongolians are one of the oldest cultures that have been practicing falconry, and it is spectacular indeed to watch. And in fact, the first female that we know of has been initiated into falconry in Mongolia. So that's pretty exciting. There's a lot of news around that. It traditionally was really more of a male-dominated sport, but we're seeing really a lot of females become involved in falconry, which is wonderful.
So this is a sport that must be fairly regulated and expensive.
Well, we like to, first of all, call it the most highly regulated hunting sport in the country, and that's because we're dealing with migratory birds, and they are all protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. So it is very involved to get your permits. It's probably maybe a little easier than, say, getting your private pilot license as a comparison, but definitely a lot of hoops to jump through, a lot of learning, and actually you need to do something fairly old school. You need to find a sponsor, somebody who's willing to teach you the art and practice of falconry free of charge for a minimum of 2 years here in the United States.
There's nothing free in this world.
Well, it's a lot of time dedication. So it is considered a world cultural heritage. So accepting money to teach someone for those 2 year period, it's just outside really the norm of what it is to pass on this tradition, right? So you really, you build a relationship with your sponsor and you, they really teach you and you go out into the field and you learn how to not only care for your bird, but also hunting techniques and really everything that's involved. And it is definitely involved. It is a lifestyle. It's not like having a pet.
Yeah. And we definitely, you know, speaking of nothing come free, well, you do have to maybe put in some time, energy, and effort to help your sponsor who generally has more than one bird. So there'll be a lot of poo cleaning and
conscripted labor for two years.
Yeah, and one of my sponsors, well, he actually owns a barn owl nest box business, and I had to go clean a number of those out, and you've never seen anything so dirty, let me tell you.
When you're looking at these birds and coming out and say, oh, I want to do that. I could do that. That would be just awesome. You know, I'm willing to drive. What does somebody have to go through in order to say, all right, are you serious? So you're looking at a sponsor and you say, okay, I did my 2 years and I'm going to start off with a golden eagle.
Well, no. You actually, here in the United States, I think it's around 7 years of experience now that you need to actually work with an eagle if you want to go hunting with one, and which is probably a good thing. Yeah, they're massive. A golden eagle, well, they can break a man's tibia and fibia with the strength in their feet. And an eagle wing could come up and they're not even trying to hurt you, but they could give you a black eye by just spreading their wings out. So it's dangerous, and you definitely want to know what you're doing before you mess with an eagle. So you're going to have to be a master falconer before you can go hunt with an eagle yourself.
Denise, tell us a little bit about the birds that I had the opportunity to, or the bird I had the opportunity to work with today, Steam.
Steam. So Steam is a Harris's hawk. Harris's hawks really were not introduced into the world of falconry until the 60s. There were two gentlemen who wrote a very large book called North American Falconry and Hunting Hawks. And in this first edition of the book, there was literally only one little bitty paragraph that said, as falconers, might want to take a closer look at the Harris's hawk. Don't know a lot about them, but we think they might make a good bird for falconry. They were essentially overlooked until that point, because when most people would look up in the sky and see these birds flying together, they thought they were vultures or some type of buzzard. These birds are among the few communal large pack hunting raptors that we have in the entire world. So there are two other species. There's the Galapagos hawk and another species of falcon on some Mediterranean islands. So really, for the mainland, they're really the only species that we have that will cooperatively hunt in these really large groups. So they are exceptional at reading body language and really good birds to work with the public with.
So is a Harris hawk then native to California, where we are right now in San Diego area?
We do have a few Harris hawks here in Southern California, not in great numbers. There's a lot more just across the border in Baja California and in Arizona. But a lot more population here. But they do roam into areas like the Anza Borrego when water is scarce, perhaps in other areas, or they're looking for more food. And also here just east of San Diego, we have a few, but not in great numbers.
Denise, you were saying a little bit, well, actually, you were saying, Kirk, that you could have one of these eagles that just stretches its wing and is just trying to position itself, and you can get a black eye, you can break your leg. Even this bird that we're working with today, Steam, tell me a little bit about why we had to be so respectful of its talons, the strength, their beak, etc.
Well, they are sharp. We like to say you're playing with sharp objects. Another word for raptors is feathered daggers, we like to say, which is pretty fun. And, well, so she has little less than half of the grip strength of an eagle, say a golden eagle.
But she was about 2 pounds?
She weighs 2 pounds, okay? And just to give you a comparison, a strong human male has around 70 to 80 pounds per square inch of gripping power in their hands. And this little 2 pound bird, she can have 400 to 500 pounds per square inch of gripping power in those feet, or you could say crushing power, right? So definitely a lot of mutual respect goes on. It's a good thing she doesn't want to use those sharp talons or beak on us.
And typically, looking at it, they don't seem to use their beak, that they're using their talons when we're out there throwing up bits of bait for them to go after.
Yeah, that is very correct. The definition of raptor is to grab or to take. So those feet are the main hunting weapon, and typically the beak is just for tearing flesh. The only thing in the wild that they'll actually hunt with their mouths are insects. And there's actually a whole colony of Harris hawks about 500 miles south down in Baja California that eats only bees. Now, could you imagine eating a quarter pounder of bees every day?
and trying to catch a quarter pound of bees every day flying through the air. That would be difficult. Denise, tell me a little bit about their eyes, because you're looking at them and it was just spectacular. Having steam on my arm, it was always a very gentle hold on my arm. I couldn't feel her talons at all. But just looking at these eyes, they seemed to be all-knowing, and she was looking everywhere at all times.
That's right. So when they are perched, of course, their instinct is always to be hunting, right? So her looking around when she's perched, she certainly does that. However, when she is in flight, she typically just focuses on her destination point. Their eyesight is about 8 times greater than that of a human being. They can see off the spectrum. So when they're up on high perches, they can literally scan the terrain for fresh urine trails that reflect the UV. They can see those hot columns of air, the thermals rising in the sky. They can see more color spectrum in the rainbow. And if they could read a book, they could read a book from, I don't know, maybe 2 miles away.
That's definitely better than 20/20.
Yes, their eyesight is really exceptional. That's their primary sense they use for hunting. They're hearing is a little bit better than ours as human beings. And then they have not developed a sense of smell. So it's understood they have olfactory senses on the roof of their mouth, which allow them to taste. And they definitely have preferences for food, but they do not use scent to hunt. So it's primarily in the eyesight.
One of the exercises that you did was to have steam on the ground. And I never really thought of a bird chasing down prey. But you were saying, Kirk, that these birds will chase down prey.
Yeah, they are very fast and agile on the ground. And Steam, our female harris hawk, she's actually caught a couple of bunnies running around on the ground, which it's amazing to watch. And you, of course, wouldn't expect it. And one of the ways that these birds, the harrises, will hunt communally, they're called the wolves of the sky, but one will go running through the bushes, flushing up game just like the falconer would. And their friends wait on the periphery. They got the flushers, chasers, grabbers. So it's pretty spectacular. And it's when they're all out together, it's called gang hawking. And they are definitely a gang.
And I think what most people, myself, really was surprised with, you have this wild bird, and tell us a little bit about captive born versus wild caught in the birds that you're using. But here's this bird, it could fly away at any time and say, bye-bye, I am not coming back. But it keeps coming back. What causes this bird to say, you know, it's really nice out here, but okay, these people aren't too bad.
Well, a lot of it has to do with really we're a good opportunity for our raptors. They know with us, they get a lot of good food. They get safety from other predators. They get fresh water. So you really strive to build and maintain a relationship of trust with your raptor. You want to give them the best life you possibly can so that they are more apt to stick around. But falconers do lose their birds. Often they will choose to go back into the wild because they are wild raptors above all of their training, especially when you get into birds like falcons who have a more migratory instinct. They can certainly fly away. And it is, I always like to say that as a falconer, your relationship continues with your bird because your bird chooses for it to continue. So there are no guarantees.
It's a good way to have a marriage. You decide you're going to stay together.
That's
it's just
right.
Not that piece of paper. So as you have this bird, wild caught versus captive. If you go out into the wild, people might say, boy, you're really affecting the environment. You're decimating these numbers. Some of these birds, there aren't that many out there. You're taking it out of the nest. That's terrible. You should leave them out in the wild. Why is it not detrimental to the environmental population?
Well, yes. Instead of being detrimental, it actually only has a positive impact on the wild populations. And, it's not a straightforward answer. First of all, these birds have a very high mortality rate in their first year of life. Over 50% will die in that first year, and by year number 3, at least 80% have died, sometimes even more. So we will typically harvest the birds from the wild in their first year of life after they've been kicked out of the nest by their parents, so they already know their birds, they already know how to fly and hunt a little bit, and so this way we can harvest them and then We give them help in hunting and flying practice, and they also get veterinary care through that toughest period in their life. And then they can be released back into the wild, say, a year or a couple years from now. And actually, traditionally, falconry, some people only will hunt their bird for a few months, typically the winter season, and then let it go. And they'll go and do their molting out in the wild and continue on as wild birds. So it actually only has a positive impact when we harvest them from the wild.
What I also found fascinating and marvelous about falconry is that the falconry organization, philosophy, association, whatever you want to call it, movement, has really done a major good deed. And Denise, thank you very much. I know you need to leave.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
And it was a pleasure to see in your birds and your home. Thank you for bringing us into it today.
Well, thank you for coming out.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Looking for the best advice on pet health, safety, and travel? Connect with the Pet Lady. Dana Humphrey, also known as the Pet Lady, will surely be in a city near you real soon. She will be spreading the good news for pets and pet lovers, from tips on dog and cat care, pet industry trends, and the best events for you and your four-legged family members. Need a great gift idea or insights on the hottest pet gadgets? Simply follow the Pet Lady on Twitter at Pet Lady World. You can also learn more at the Pet Lady at thepetlady.net.
Franklin is part beagle and part yellow lab. He was rescued in 2010 from the streets of Los Angeles. Somebody threw him out of a car and shattered his leg. He was malnourished and emaciated. He was also shedding excessively. The vet bills, the prescriptions, became increasingly expensive. And he wasn't eating. That led me to look for other food sources for Franklin, including a raw dog food diet. I found the entire recipe, which incorporated raw meat, eggs, rice, Dinovite, and Lico Chops, his omega-3 supplement, on Dinovite.com.
Dinovite.com.
859-428-1000.
Now he's thriving. He's shedding much less. He never misses mealtime, and his coat is soft and shiny. Like that you guys are focusing on rescue dogs, I think every rescue deserves at least 90 days of Dinovite. 859-428-1000. Start that little pet off right. Just go to Dinovite.com.
Dinovite.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
So with these birds, peregrine falcons, I understand, were endangered for a period of time, and it was falconry that brought it back from that brink of destruction.
Yes, I wouldn't say just falconers, but definitely a lot of these falconers had these birds in captivity. By the 1960s, we almost lost that peregrine, the fastest animal on the planet, clocking at 250 plus miles an hour. I like to say by the summer of love, the eastern seaboard variety was completely extinct and the western seaboard variety on massive decline. But because falconers had these birds in captivity, got together with the rehabbers and other interested parties and started groups like the Peregrine Fund and learned how to breed these birds in captivity, possibly for the first time in captivity of working with these birds for thousands of years, and we got permission from the government to release them. Happy to report, as of 2012, they're at or higher than historic numbers. Some cases double those historic numbers. So actually, very quickly, we can have a positive impact on the natural world around us if we so choose and learn how to do new things.
What does it involve, being this is a veterinary program, of the veterinary care, the nutritional care for these birds? Because I think some people would look at it going, wow, this is really cruel. You know, you keep these birds here at all times, and they're tethered, and they're in their mews, which is their cage as such. That's really cruel.
Well, not really. So first of all, in the wild, an average day for a raptor, they will only fly around 20 minutes a day, typically only to work for their living or guard their territory. Otherwise, they are happy just perched and hanging out. So as long as they have, you know, enough food, we got a raven here hanging out.
Do we need to do something?
No, absolutely fine. Yeah, they're talking to the hawk here. Yeah.
This is my territory. I know that you're not going to go after me, so haha.
We like to call that one Einstein. Those corvids are definitely a lot smarter than the raptors. But back to what we were talking about here. Yeah, you're distracting us, Einstein.
So it's not cruel keeping these birds because, again, if they didn't like you, they could take off.
Yeah, we free fly all of our birds, and they know how to fly. They know how to hunt. If they wanted to go back into the wild, they could definitely survive and do so. So it's their choice to come back, and they know the drill, and they come back.
And what do you have to do for veterinary care? Do they need to go into your local avian specialist?
Yes. Typically, when we harvest a bird from the wild, we will take them to an avian specialist veterinary's office and get some of those parasites off them that they could have in the wild. They might have some conditions like bumblefoot or other diseases. We definitely, you know, want to get them checked out.
And what is bumblefoot for those people that don't know?
Oh, it's a condition you can get from bad perches. You get like kind of blisters on the feet, and it's really nasty and pretty bad.
Foot problems, okay.
Yeah.
And one thing I learned today, I did not realize you had a little spray bottle because it was getting fairly warm out there and that you were spraying down Steam's feet.
Yeah, their feet is the only place where they can thermal regulate. So
just like a dog.
There you go. And so actually a penguin will incubate their eggs down by their feet because it's the only place where they can pass.
We've seen happy feet.
Yeah. And so we use that to cool them off. We can spray their feet and if they're perched next to their bath pans, or we like to say their infinity pools, they'll just hang out there and cool their feet off on a hot day.
And right now we're looking at Steam, and she's perched on an area where she's out in the sun, and it's pretty warm out there. No concern with her? She can just sit there?
Yeah, no concern. She's the Harris Hawks are a southwest desert bird, and they live in the 115-degree Sonoran Desert, but they're not flying around when it's really hot out. And we actually don't like to fly our birds over much above 80 degrees. So, they're fine hanging out in the heat, no problem. But they would prefer it in the refrigerator, you know, 45 degrees. And if I was wearing a down jacket, I would too.
I mean, they are absolutely gorgeous. One of the things I thought was interesting too is that they only fly during the day, and at night they are definitely prey, no longer predator.
That is correct. So these types of raptors, the hawks, eagles, and falcons, they're diurnal. So that means that they only see during the day. They actually can't see at all during the night, or barely at all. And so when it gets dark, they want to go up to their roost, hang out as calmly as possible, and hope that that boogie owl, or excuse me, the great horned owl, doesn't come and snatch them out of their roost. So it's a pretty cruel world out there, and that the great horned owl is their biggest predator in the wild, and it has all the advantages. These birds will chase them during the day, but at night they don't have any advantage whatsoever.
Speaking of chasing, I think we've all seen hawks, falcons that are out there flying around, and they're being dive-bombed by these little dicky birds. And it's like, really? Why don't you just turn around and just pick at it, you know, put a talon in it, do whatever. They're just bugging you. You're a big bird. Why don't they go after the smaller birds?
Well, so they're, first of all, the raptors are opportunistic. If it's not a good opportunity to go after the other bird, well, they're not going to. It's going to be a big waste of energy. So it's fight or flight instinct that kicks in. It's a lot easier to fly away than it is to get into a fight, and definitely a lot safer and less energy consumption in general. So during nesting season, all these other birds get very territorial of the raptors because, well, the raptors are nest robbers, as well as those crows, ravens, and gulls, amongst others, right? So everybody gets very territorial in the late spring and summer, and it's actually pretty normal for a raptor to be harassed by them, by any of those birds. And actually, one time I was flying with one of my birds in a paraglider, summertime, during nesting season on the coast, and there happened to be a crow convention or something, and all these nesting birds are, you know, and a bunch of crows and even ravens and gulls, it must have been around 100, teamed up and chased my bird back, Shanti, a Harris Hawk, back into the university campus there by Torrey Pines. And so I land, I go back and get her on my glove, and still 50 crows escorted us out of campus, jumping from rooftop to rooftop. So it was very Hitchcockonian. So they do get harassed a lot, and they do not call them a murder of crows for nothing. They can actually will kill juvenile raptors as well. They're so smart, they can tell the plumage apart and will attack these juveniles. And also, it's not just the crows and ravens and gulls. Well, mockingbirds, you know, these other little birds that you were talking about. One time I had a bird out. She was hanging out on a post. I timed a mockingbird 45 minutes, just meow, pff, hit her. Meow, pff. She's just sitting on the post preening, and this mockingbird would not leave her alone, right? And I'm just, how does this bird have that much energy, first of all, which I thought was amazing to harass the Harris hawk for that long. But she just kept on preening, and, you know, it ended, and nothing happened.
You were saying that, you know, the hawks will be out there stealing from other nests, etc., looking for food. As we were doing our hawk walk today, one of the things I thought was interesting, as these birds are so focused on coming to our glove or in the wild, focused on getting the food, as to why, you know, you think they ran into a car, or a car, you know, hit them, or they ran into electrical wires. Why didn't they see that? Their eyesight is so good. And Denise was talking about even throwing food out of your window as you're driving. Oh, it's biodegradable. It's an apple core, whatever. You throw it out of your window, and a bird will many times see that, go after it on a road, and get hit.
Well, not that necessarily. It is what you're doing when you throw that food or anything biodegradable out your car window. You're attracting what these raptors eat to the roadside, like mice and bunnies. Mm-hmm. And the raptors naturally like to be in a lot of the open areas, which our roads are. And they're hanging out on top of the light posts, these nice tall perches that we've put there for them. And, they will get locked in with their binocular vision when they chase a mouse across the road, and they fly really low to the ground, and they don't look both ways before they cross the street. And that's how they get hit so frequently. So it happens anyway, because those little critters are there by the road, but we don't need to add to that problem.
And what are some of the other environmental stressors put on these animals? Of course, number one, there's just so many people where they need to live and hunt. But what are some of the other major concerns?
Well, some of the biggest are power lines. Not only do they collide with them, but they will get electrocuted. And sometimes they will fall down and ignite the underbrush, like the big Barona fire that we had here in the past decade here.
Southern California.
Yeah. Very destructive fire. And a lot of these things can be even prevented by putting $4 parts up there on the power lines to cover up the exposed sections.
And you were also talking about wind turbines, that they're not your favorite things.
Well, no, I mean, of course, I'm a fan of green energy, but done responsibly. Each wind turbine, on average, all around the world, kills around 20 birds annually. Now, if you add that up here in the United States, that's around 100,000 raptors every year alone here are killed just by wind turbines. Over 500,000 birds every year in the U.S. are killed just by wind turbines. And believe it or not, over 1 million bats every year just in the U.S. are killed by wind turbines. And with our current energy policies, we're only putting up more, and we're only putting up more power lines that hook these wind turbines up to the grid. We're putting up power lines that stretch over 100 miles, and you lose 40% of the energy when you transmit power this far. So even if we were getting power from green sources, like, say, wind turbines or solar fields out in the desert, well, when you transmit power that far, you lose all that energy, and it's what we call a green wash.
Well, I was washed today by these great feelings of having this bird, you know, being able to watch this gorgeous bird and then having it on my arm. Sky falconry does more than just entertain people here. It really does a lot of education. Tell me a little bit about what sky falconry does for education purposes.
Well, it's our main goal is to get people up close and have that personal interaction with the raptors, because I personally feel that if you don't know something, you can't love it or then care about it. So we absolutely do bombard you with a lot of information. It might be a little TMI sometimes, and we don't expect you to remember everything that we teach when you come here, but as long as you come away with the feeling that you had a great time, and I think everybody does, it's probably the funnest thing to do here in Southern California. I might be biased.
I'm slightly prejudiced, but yes, I might agree with you.
And these birds also have a job. Didn't you use them as abatement animals?
Yeah. Abatement, we like to call it natural pest control. We use the raptors to scare away gulls and other pesty animals from resorts and vineyards and even airports to keep them away from the overpriced hamburgers, let's say.
And not having bird strikes when you're trying to take off from an airport.
Exactly.
Kirk Selinger of Sky Falconry, what's something that you haven't told us that, what was the most fabulous flight that you've ever had with a bird?
Is that me flying a bird on the ground?
Anything. Your best experience of being with one of your birds.
Well, I would say just the general experience of being able to take people from the public out with our birds and giving them that hands-on experience. It definitely gets me a little emotional. I was editing some video footage last night and you know, just getting to go see how excited people get. I got a little emotional watching it. And
you do para-hawking also, don't you?
Yes, but we definitely don't offer that to the public.
Oh, dang. But what is para-hawking for those of us that want to go, ooh, I want to do that, I want to do that?
Well, that is flying with a trained bird of prey in your paraglider. Sometimes they help you find lift. You know, they're better at finding those thermals, those rising columns of hot air that take you up into the sky without having to flap. Yeah, if you want to go to our website, skyfalconry.com, and check out the para-hawking tab, you can see a really cool video of me and our bird, Shanti.
And we all, yeah. Ooh.
Yeah, it's really fantastic. And now, but I really love that bird in particular. She was one of the first birds I worked with. And not only do I get to fly with her, go hunting with her, I get to fly her to the public as well. And it is just, it's what a relationship to have with a bird. I love it.
And seeing the joy in your eyes, yes. And I had to smile because so many of my pet owners, when they come in, they refer to themselves as mom and dad. And then watching you and Denise out there with the bird, Steam's like, come to mommy, go to daddy. And it's like, yes, this is definitely a relationship built on love and trust.
Yeah, it is. And it's kind of how we think about it, but we don't want them to think of us as mommy and daddy. We really want them to think of us as good hunting partners.
Well, this is Dr. Bernadine Cruz. I'm in the gorgeous foothills of San Diego looking at a fabulous bird by the name of Steam, chatting with its hunting partner, Kirk Selinger, and skyfalconry.com. Please go to their site. If you're here in Southern California, come visit. You have also a site in Sacramento.
Yeah, that's our sister school, West Coast Falconry. They're about an hour and a half northeast of Sacramento and outside a small town called Marysville. Spectacular place. They have even more birds than we do, offer more experiences. So if you're ever up that direction, come check them out.
So please listen again next week. We'll have more information on how to make you the best possible pet owner. Thanks for listening.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life because they're a member of the family. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.